Welcome to the first in this series of lectures on the framers of Anglican identity. And this afternoon we're going to be talking about Richard Hooker and Lancelot Andrews. And, you know, the whole business of having lectures about Anglican identity is a very odd business in a way, because if you'd asked somebody in 16th or century, 17th century about how do you feel about being Anglican, they'd have looked at you blankly. There was no such thing, really. And the whole search for Anglican identity, which has been going on in the last couple of decades, is a new thing too. And what's different about it is that, when people are feeling self-confident and sure of who they are, sure of their identity, they don't think about this. And there's been a real sense of conundrum and uncertainty about what we are as a church. And this is why all these kind of issues have come up. And I'm hoping that over the next couple of months, as I talk about certain people who've helped to make the Church of England the way it is, that certain issues, dilemmas and questions will be thrown into fresh light, because these people both built up who we are as an identity, but also posed some of the dilemmas that we're now in. And most people would say that Richard Hooker was a very important and influential part of the emerging Church of England from the 16th century. But first of all, I think I need to talk a bit of background about what actually happened at the Protestant Reformation in the Atlantic Islands before I start talking about these two individuals. Now, when I was at secondary school in the late 60s, the textbooks, the standard textbooks, the line they took was that the Reformation in England was an incredibly popular thing. People were just longing for it to happen. It was broadly supported and happened quite smoothly for that reason, with just a few dead enders kind of resisting the process. Lately, there's been a revisionist view of what happened at the English Reformation, spearheaded in particular by a Catholic historian, Oxbridge, by the name of Eamon Duffy, and he's argued that in fact this was what he called the unrequested Reformation, that a small elite group influenced Henry VIII and successive monarchs to push through the Reformation, that by and large it was unpopular with the English population. He's kind of drilled down into village life and talked about the power of local guilds. I mean, working guilds had particular festivals and feast days and charitable causes they supported, and chantry chapels. And a lot of village life and its mythic and ritual life was bound up with the festivals of the church. And in particular, England was known to be very hot on the cult of Mary, which seems very odd for a country that was thirsting to go engage in the Protestant Reformation. And there's counter-arguments against that revisionist view now. But the thing is that Henry VIII, as it got underway, moved by due legal process. Maybe he manipulated constitutional means, but he didn't effect a revolution. He just made gradual changes. And what Henry had created was a medieval church with only two changes. He'd abolished the monasteries, and he'd replaced the leadership of the church from the Bishop of Rome to himself. One Catholic historian said, Henry had with him the needy and the greedy and the rich and the noisy. What now replaced it was what's called the Erastian paradigm, i.e. the notion of the godly prince as the head of the church. And maybe that seems a bit odd to us, but it wasn't so odd then. Because right from the time Christianity was accepted as the official religion of the Roman Empire, the emperor of Rome, and in particular the Eastern Roman Emperor, had claimed for themselves considerable rights to interfere in the life of the church. For instance, the Council of Nicaea in 325, which is the kind of basis of the creed we say on Sunday, because there was a major row going on in the life of the church as to whether Jesus Christ was fully divine and fully human, the Emperor Constantine knew that the church was divided. He was the one who had said, okay, we're all Christians now, and he called together the Ecumenical Council. He turned up at it. He strongly pushed bishops to agree about this. And from then on, whenever there was a row in the church, bishops tended to turn to the emperor as their last court of appeal. And in fact, the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, one of his official titles, was that he was equal to the apostles. And the way in which the church governed itself in the first 800 years of its life was what's by means of what's called the Pentarchy. In other words, the five archbishops of the most important sees, they being Alexandria, Jerusalem, Antioch, Constantinople, and Rome. If those five could agree about a major controversial issue, that settled it. And if that still didn't settle things, you can call an ecumenical council. And if that didn't settle things, you ask the emperor to adjudicate. So it really mattered what theological position the emperor had. So right from the go-get, there had been a long history of the people at the top, politically speaking, having a substantial say in the way in which the church ran. And right through the Middle Ages, there was a thing called the investiture contest, first named because a man called Hildebrand, who became Pope Gregory, publicly humiliated the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, forced him to walk through the snow to the place of Canossa, to acknowledge the right of the Bishop of Rome to appoint bishops throughout the Holy Roman Empire. That wasn't the end of the story. This tug of war went on right through the Middle Ages between kings and Pope as to who had the right to choose bishops within a country. And that mattered because, you see, the way you control the church in a worldwide sense is by choosing the bishops. That's how the Pope rolled the bishop of the Roman Catholic Church. And increasingly, kings got the upper hand in this contest because the church was the most powerful institution in their realm. It was too powerful to be left to its own devices and their humble opinion, and they wanted to make very sure that they were calling the shots as to who were its local leaders. So, given all this, people were, rulers, expected the right more and more to intervene in the life of the church. What it also kind of opened things up had been the fact, of course, that in the High Middle Ages, the Western Church was divided in its leadership for several decades by what's called the Great Schism, when there was a Pope of Avignon, the south of France, and a Pope in Rome. And this was deeply confusing and scandalous to people. And in the end, the issue was resolved when a council, an ecumenical council, was called up in the French city of Constance. It met for several years. It deposed all the present popes and defined them as anti-popes. It raised up a new one. It made a whole lot of controversial decisions in the life of the church, including the decision to invite the Protestant heretic Jan Hus to a meeting, ambush him, try him for heresy, and burn him at the stake. Well, what happened after that is that the resurgent papacy got ahead of the conciliar process and made very sure indeed that in future those kind of councils wouldn't be making the decisions. But this memory stayed in the hearts and minds of many reforming Christians in the Western Church who felt, gee, Constance reminds us of how it could be that the big decisions could be made by a gathering of all the bishops, their theologians and the leading abbots. And this potent memory kind of remained there to help influence what happened at the Reformation in England. So Henry's church was a medieval church without monasteries or the Pope. There was a brief lurch to Protestantism under Edward VI because his advisers and protectors were very keen on that. When he died very young, there's a lurch to the Catholic, through the restoration of Catholicism under Mary, but she cannot produce an heir and dies herself. And then in 1559, along comes Elizabeth I, who will reign for the rest of the century and will begin to define what the Church of England will be. And this is where we pick up the story. Now, in Elizabeth's church, of course, one of the major inheritances it has is that Cranmer, first of all, Henry's helper in a little task force to readjust his matrimonial affairs, then the Archbishop of Canterbury, had begun, he couldn't begin the process of prayer reform until Henry had died. Henry was so conservative that the Mass continued to be celebrated in Latin. And first of all, Cranmer publishes his 1549 prayer book, which, you know, Anglo Catholics today are very happy with because it's read as the Catholic Mass translated into English with Cranmer's rather wonderful prayers as well. The thing is, he got it the right order in terms of the way in which it reads as a Eucharistic prayer. But nobody was really happy with 1549. The Conservatives wanted to go back to the Latin Mass, and the Radicals and the Reformers wanted something rather more drastic. So in 1552, Cranmer came along with the next prayer book, and in particular, he really got to work on the communion service. He sawed the Eucharistic prayer in half. He inserted some several devotional prayers to kind of break up the Catholic rhythm of it all. He took out the invocation of the Holy Spirit, of the bread and wine, and it had a bit of tinkering in 1559 as Elizabeth came to power. But what happened now was that the prayer book, which the Church of England wasn't entirely happy with, it couldn't get rid of it, It couldn't change it very much. It couldn't even change it very much in 1662. But it had to accept it as an enduring part of its life, as one historian called it, an enzyme that worked its way through the life of the church and helped, particularly during the Commonwealth period after the Civil War, to make the Reformation what it called a howling success. So this was to be a national church directed by the monarch through the leadership of the bishops who she would choose. So, despite top-down control, this is still rather unresolved what kind of church the Church of England would be. There was no such thing as Anglicanism. There's rather radical Puritanism, there's emergent Presbyterianism, and there's emergent Anglicanism, all kind of jockeying for power in this period. And what we have to understand is that Calvinism, Reformed religion, Puritanism holds the ideological high ground through this time. It's the idea whose time has come. It has the power of the new. And most of the leaders in the Elizabethan church were Puritans of one kind or another, modified Puritans, loyal to the Queen. But in terms of their theological thinking, they were very shaped by what Calvin and the Puritans had to say. So one of the five key points of Calvinism as they would begin to work their way out in the life of Reformed churches. First of all, the unconditional decree by God of election. That is to say, God has chosen from before the foundation of the world who shall be saved. He made that choice before the human race came into existence. And when you have double predestination, that means, of course, he also chose from the beginning who would be damned. Point two is the limiting of Christ's atoning death for humanity to those who are elected to salvation. In other words, on the cross, Christ did not die for everybody, he died for those who had been elected to be saved. It was a limited atonement, not universal. Point number three, the total corruption of humankind. That is to say, he believed in the doctrine of total depravity, that at the fall, humankind had been so deeply damaged by original sin that it could not, unaided and of its own efforts, make its way back to God, and would have considerable difficulty developing and forming a relationship with God unless God, through Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit, continually kind of repaired and restored that relationship. Point number four, the irresistibility of God's grace, something that Augustine of Hippo had been very keen on. If God makes up his mind to do something in the world, nothing can stop him. His grace cannot be resisted in any way. And the final point was the unchallengeable perseverance and saving grace of God's elect. Those who have been chosen before the foundation of the world will be saved, and they will go on to attain salvation because God will make sure it's so, through his irresistible grace. The other thing that they were very keen on was that lay people should run the local church and they should have the decisive say in choosing their ministers. Which ironically is the point we've almost got to now in Anglicanism, but never was the way it was in the 16th century, because the local vicar was chosen either by the lay patron or a university college or the crown. The locals did not choose their vicar. That of course means also that the local church had the right to fire their minister if he wasn't up to scratch. And that, of course, is the way it is in Presbyterianism. As I shall be arguing, the Presbyterian Church, in its classical form, as it arrived in Dunedin in the 19th century, is what the Puritans wanted the Church of England to be. The fascinating thing about the classical Presbyterian Church is that we are looking at the alternative vision and version of who we could have been. And that all of this was up for grabs and up for contestation right through the 15th, 16th and 17th centuries. So, how did the Puritans try to gain control of the Church of England? Well, first of all, they did it by appointing lecturers. Supposing there was a powerful Puritan faction within this parish, they would come together and raise a whole lot of money to pay for a lecturer. Oh, Vicar, we can help you. We need to bring this on to a Bible teacher into this parish. We'll pay for him, don't need to worry about that. We'll find a house for him, and he will just, you know, assist you helping to run the parish. I'm sure you'll agree with that. We know that you have trouble preaching sermons. You have to understand that many, if not most, vicars in the 16th century did not write or preach their own sermons. A lot of them didn't preach at all, And that's why when Cranmer came to power, one of the first things he did was to issue what's called the Book of Homilies. Look, guys, read these, Sunday by Sunday. Which is very clever, because then you know what's going to be preached from the pulpit, time after time. Only a small minority of the clergy were literate enough or cared enough to write their own sermons and deliver them. And one of the huge struggles of the Elizabethan church and the Jacobean church is to create an educated clergy who can now preach regularly. That was just, it took a struggle involving generations to get to that point. The other thing they did was to have a national survey published just as Parliament met, in which they surveyed 2,500 parishes and produced hilarious and scandalous accounts of what was going on in parishes, with particular reference to slack clergy who were immoral in their lifestyle, slack about teaching ministries, and kind of surveyed as to how disciplined and committed parishes were. Very helpful for historians. But you see, the idea is that Parliament meets, here's this in-depth research. Hey guys, things aren't so great up there in the Church of England as you want it to be. And this is why we need to lift our game. Even wittier were the Martin Marprelate tracts. These were satirical underground literature in which they supposedly written by Martin, the evil prelate, in which it lampooned a particularly scandalous clergy, particular major failings in the church, and were of course a great cause of hilarity to those who read it. And the Elizabethan authorities spent a lot of time trying to track down the authors of the Marprelate tracts and to punish them severely. The fourth means of trying to gain power was through what's called prophesying. That is to say, prayer meetings and services outside of vicarial or episcopal control. Oh, Vicar, we're just going to meet in somebody's house and read the Bible a bit, and I'll do a bit of teaching. No need for you to turn up, we'll just take all this. So the point of all this was that a kind of parachurch had come into existence in certain parishes through what we would call the house group movement. They didn't have house groups in those days. We'll just have a good night at church. No need for you to come along, we'll take care of all that. So all of this went on right through the 16th century. So what the Puritans wanted was a well-regulated, highly disciplined, with high standards church, with worthy participation in the baptism and the Eucharist, a church of true Christians. You know, in classic Presbyterianism, the elders would go out before the quarterly communion service to talk to everybody in their homes and to issue them the ticket to come along. And the point of this was, a very good idea, make sure they're up to scratch. Make sure this is a convinced Christian who deserves their sacramental qualifications. So, on the scene now comes Richard Hooker, who was a bright boy from a socially eclipsed West Country family. And he advanced through an educational transmission belt, which was very common in the medieval church. Because the medieval church used to pick talented boys who it thought could advance if they were given a dose of higher education to do the church a power of good. And in this particular case, the Bishop of Exeter, John Jewell, the first ideologue, really, of the Church of England, modified Puritan, singled Richard Hooker out and began to put him on the upward path to an Oxford education. He became Oxford Don, a professor of logic, not rhetoric, and his tutor at Oxford was John Reynold, a Puritan activist, and he became a mentor. And Richard Hooker becomes tutor then to Edwin Sandys, who's the son of the Bishop of London. And this again is another key promotional step up. He's getting known amongst the hierarchy. And then he was spotted by the Queen's talent scouts who were looking for a preacher at Paul's Cross. Now, what Paul's Cross was a kind of outdoor preaching venue. It was a kind of, you know, those kind of wayside pulpits you see outside some London churches, sort of under the Grand, and the elite of London and the court would gather in sort of seats ranked around it, presumably it wasn't raining, to hear sermons. Incredible to believe today, but the preachers at Paul's Cross had to be people who were both good at preaching but also were on message with what Elizabeth I wanted heard from the best pulpits. And so here's Richard Hooker's big breakthrough. He's chosen as guest preacher at Paul's Cross, and he does well. He's got a kind of rhetorical flair and a depth of argument. So now he's really well away in his terms of his promotional prospects. Now, what Elizabeth wanted was a moderate reformation in religious practice within the established church, headed by the crown, a church not marked by purity of discipline, as by a welcoming spirit of compromise, inclusion and accommodation among a variety of acceptable positions. So now that Hooker's on the way up, he's first of all made the vicar of St. Mary's Beauchamp in Buckinghamshire, and then his big chance comes in 1585 when he's made master of the Temple Church. This looks good because there's a wealthy mercantile congregation, quite educated for its time, but there's a fly in the ointment. They have a lecturer there, a Puritan called Walter Travis, who, as we should be hearing, was a leading ideologue of the Puritans. And when Hooker is instituted as the master of the Temple Church in London, what does he do that's different to what's been going on there? Well, he restores the Book of Common Prayer. They haven't been using that. He introduces choral music and chanting. There's regular celebrations of the Holy Communion. That was unusual for that church. He didn't memorize his sermons. He preached from a text. He was a slightly boring preacher. But you see, Puritans memorize their sermons. They believe, you know, it's all about sincerity. Look them in the eye. Preach for a long period of time off a text which you've memorized. It must have required staggering skill. And Hooker says, well, you know, preaching is important, but it's not the most important thing. So now, common prayer, as we would call it, is the dominant worship idiom. So what happens is, in the morning, Hooker will use the liturgy. He'll often celebrate the communion service. He'll read his sermons. In the afternoon, Mr. Travis, who stayed away from the morning service, his acolytes and disciples have been to the morning service. They've taken notes on what Hooker had to say. They rushed off to Travis' place. Travis lays it at his desk. He writes another sermon, contradicting everything Hooker's just said. He memorizes it, and he preaches it in a long sermon-led service in the afternoon with no liturgy. I mean, the guy must have been very bright indeed. And this went on for several years. As somebody said, it was from Canterbury in the morning and Geneva from the pulpit in the afternoon. And this power struggle, which must have been exhausting for everybody, just went on for quite some time. In the end, the Archbishop of Canterbury removed Travis from his post at the Temple Church. In other words, he was sacked as a lecturer. He remained in his house to mastermind the Presbyterian machinations across Britain. And eventually his cash was cut off and he left in 1587 to lead a declining movement. He was, as somebody put it, the John Knox of Britain. Well, you'd have thought that Richard Hooker had won the battle now and he should just carry on and transform the life of the Temple Church. In reality, he'd been worn out by this. He was a kind of shy, introverted kind of a guy. He didn't like controversy. He didn't like conflict. And he decided to toss in the towel at the Temple Church and to take a more retiring position. So he thought it was time to analyse, write, preach, instruct, console and inspire away from political life. And so he starts writing The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity in 1589, which will run to quite a few volumes. It's a thoughtful, clear exposition of the special quality of this reformed English church. And the general plan is to address issues raised by Calvinist challengers and extremists, not by refuting them one at a time, but by examining the nature of all truth and knowledge, and then addressing the question about how to discover the right answer to any important question. Yeah, he was appointed to a variety of non-residentiary jobs, so he could resign as the master of the temple and live with an income. What I mean by that is, he was vicar of several churches, but he didn't actually run them. You employed poor curates to do all that while you garnered the income and to get on with what you, as we should hear, this was quite common in the 16th century. By 1595, he's completed the Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity. He becomes the rector of Bishopsbourne and he dies in 1600, only in his 40s. But let's remember, the 16th century, 40s is a long life by comparison. In many ways, Richard Hooker was an underachiever who fails to advance due to lack of his doctorate to his married state. And it's hard to believe Elizabeth I didn't like married clergy. She thought that Rome had it right, best to have single clergy, more focused on the job, less inclined to cause trouble and demand money. He was diffident, there was a lack of stomach for controversies and conflict that were inevitable in public life. So, but he left this depth charge behind him, his books. And the depth charge slowly went off over the years. So what did the laws of ecclesiastical polity actually say? God is rational, he operates through rationality, his ways in the world are reasonable, dependable, reliable. He operates through laws that indicate his wisdom, his peaceableness, commending himself to human beings' good sense. So there's an emphasis on reason. The Bible can't be read off like a maker's manual to provide the architectural structure of the church. God relies on us to work things out from the scriptures as source, but take into consideration what has been before, what is known to have worked well in the past, and the usages and customs that commend themselves to reasonable people in a stable and traditional society. So there's an emphasis on traditional, or tradition, but not just being traditional in the sense of having a conservative habit of mind, but looking to the church's tradition in its formative years in the patristic period. By the patristic period, I mean about the first 500 or 600 years of the church's life, when some very powerful minds indeed kind of made up the classical doctrines of the Christian church, and when the ecumenical councils defined the creeds that we use in Sunday worship. Like Lancelot Andrews, who I'll be talking about next, he is well read in the patristical period. He's able to quote patristic fathers and to use them to buttress his arguments. But it's not just patristic sources. He also quoted Thomas Aquinas. Scandalous thing, many Protestant reformers people would think. And what Thomas Aquinas had said is that nature and grace complement each other. The way in which God reaches out to us through revelation and divine grace is kind of paralleled by the structures of the world and the way it's built. And he notes that Puritans have to use considerable ingenuity to read off the details of the ecclesiastical polity they claim the Bible prescribes for the church. In other words, the Bible doesn't actually say you should have teaching elders and stuff like that. You have to kind of use quite a bit of ingenuity and rationality to draw those conclusions from what Scripture says. He made a key distinction between beliefs essential for salvation, here the Bible tends to speak to us directly, and things not essential, that are indifferent, where Christians are free to work out what's best on reasonable assumptions drawn from tradition and scriptural hints, i.e. the ordering of the church. What the Windsor Report calls adiaphora, in other words, matters indifferent, but Christians are free to disagree. It's not going to be the end of the world if you don't agree about this. So, for instance, what about bishops then? Well, Hooker thinks that episcopacy, episcopal ordering of the church, is the best way to arrange the life of the church. It comes down to us from apostolic times and the early church, but it's not essential for the life of the church. A church lacking episcopal government lacks the fullness of what it should have, but does not cease to be the church or to mediate salvation to its members. Now, you know, Anglo-Catholics and Tractarians 200 years later would claim Richard Hooker was one of their own, but this was a very embarrassing point for them. Because Anglo-Catholics believe in what's called an episcopal paradigm for the church. The church must have episcopacy. Bishops are the successors of the apostles. And in order to be a genuine church, you've got to have bishops. No, says Hooker, highly desirable. Have it wherever you can, but not a die in a ditch point. The church can be a valid church without bishops. He says that episcopal ordinations are necessary in the Church of England, but in two instances, it could be imagined that this might not be essential. If God wanted to raise someone up to spiritual leadership for an exceptional situation, and the normal channels of ordination might not be possible or appropriate, or in an emergency situation where no bishops were left or available and necessary to provide a continuing ministry for the church, so priests might ordain priests. So let's imagine as a, you know, an Anglican settlement after a shipwreck on an island. Life goes on, there are some priests but no bishops. He would say, well, priests are free to ordain other priests in order to keep the life of the Anglican church on that island going. In continental European Protestant Reformation, it was often not initiated by a godly prince who would insist on episcopacy, so these churches can't be blamed for not having it. So Hooker refuses to unchurch European Protestant churches or to say that their sacraments aren't valid. So for him, episcopacy flows from the godly prince, not from the episcopal paradigm. He strongly believes in the divine right of kings, rather than the apostolic succession as the Tractarians would believe. He likewise refuses to say that Catholics aren't Christians. Although their church has many errors and superstitions, a humble, simple, honest believer who walks humbly with their God and is conscientiously doing their best according to their lights will be saved. Now, this is a very unpopular point of view to believe amongst Reformation kind of hot believers in 16th century England. So he's moderate, he's a renick, it's a tolerant point of view, another motif that will emerge in Anglicanism. He deplores and laments Puritans seeming to criticise the Church of England leaders for not hating Catholics enough. Like Elizabeth, he, as long as the church members participate in the life of the church, take part intelligently in common prayer or its prayer book, conform to its usages, there's a deep reluctance to inquire into their inner belief systems, to police who is fit and worthy to take part in the life of the church. In other words, Elizabeth said, okay, here's the deal. Turn up to church on Sunday, worship according to the Book of Common Prayer. By the way, they were fined if they didn't turn up to church. That's okay. That's all we're asking for you to do. Or we'll maybe pay tithes, I suppose. We're not going to inquire too closely into what you believe. We're not going to conduct doctrine tests. And that's quite helpful in a way, because we shall see later on there are problems that emerge from this. I remember when Peter Jensen, the Archbishop of Sydney, was crossing Christchurch a few years back, and I went to hear this talk he gave at St. Christopher's Avonhead, and he used a phrase I've never heard before. And in many ways, Peter Jensen's been pushing the Puritan agenda again. And he said, there are people in high positions in the Anglican Church who are hiding in the church. What he meant by that was, they don't truly believe in the love of Christ crucified, they haven't truly accepted Jesus Christ as their Lord and Saviour, but they found the church a really convenient place to be. It's a comfortable place to kind of make their life. They've often, through sheer ability, risen quite high, but they ain't the real deal. And this is why he said evangelicals are always keen to hear from their vicar in his preaching as to whether he really has accepted Jesus Christ as their personal Lord and Saviour.
So, Hooker backs up Elizabeth's repudiation of the Church of England becoming a confessional church. Now, this is a decisive point in current rows going on in the communion. There are those within the Global South and the GAFCON community who want to say that Anglicanism needs to have a charter of belief. This is what we must believe. Again, in the Sydney Diocese, ordinands at Moore Theological College are taught that 39 articles is what that is. We believe this. The Reformation hasn't been completed. We must roll on through and do what ought to have happened under Elizabeth, according to the Puritans, I think. So doctrinal uniformity did not interest Elizabeth. Uniformity of outward profession of faith and unity of national purposes did. So theological independence is allowed from the start. And as we'll be hearing later on, this is fine in many ways, but it's going to create later problems for the Church of England. Hooker's attitude to worship, oh, you'll love this, it's a process of aesthetic transformation. The beauty of worship changes us. It's a collective experience through sharing in common prayer, as opposed to individual transformation by means of a disciplined church. Reciting the Psalms tames the passions. Choral music and singing in church educates the affections. I love that phrase, yes. In other words, maybe I'm not terribly awake or my heart and soul aren't in it this morning, but the music will carry me along. It will slowly work its way with me over time. Hence, a reluctance to overvalue the sermon. Faith isn't just what we hear and understand. There's a reluctance to get drawn into precise explanations of Eucharistic doctrine. He's certainly drawn to the language of mystical indwelling in Cranmer's Calvinist motifs in the Eucharist. But he emphasises what the Eucharist does to us, what it does in us, rather than what it does to the bread and wine.
So it's a kind of pragmatic and action-oriented approach to Eucharistic theology. Of Calvin, he says, he's a respected theological master who any Christian can profitably learn from.
Perhaps the most important theological figure of Protestantism, someone to listen to with respect. It's always worth reading him, but he is not the be-all and end-all. His pronouncements are not the end of an argument, the authoritative end of the matter on any issue that might arise. And this is a point of view that would have grieved his Puritan mentors and many Puritans in the Church of England. Well, the laws of ecclesiastical polity were published slowly. They were never translated into Latin, so they weren't read much on the continent. But they operated like a kind of delayed debt charge in the life of the Church of England, slowly going off in later years, and little by little becoming the yardstick, the measure, and the ideological underpinning of emergent Anglicanism. The good that he did lived long after him. I'm turning now to Lancelot Andrews, who really is a figure of a generation on under King James I. Like Hooker, he's propelled forward into considerable usefulness to the national church by his intellectual brilliance. He was a swot and a geek if ever there was one. He was proficient in 15 modern languages and 6 ancient languages. It's immense breadth of learning, a learning not original, speculative or creative, but a great collector and organiser of what was known into something fresh. He's a man of prodigious industry, retentive memory, and he's Cambridge rather than Oxford in his origins. If Hooker missed out on public life and shrank from high office, that certainly couldn't be said about Lancelot Andrews.
He began as the vicar of St Giles Cripplegate in the Diocese of London and chaplain to the Queen. In 1601 he becomes the Dean of Westminster Cathedral. He's one of the translators of the King James Bible, and he chaired the committee that translated from the book of Genesis to the 2 Kings. In 1605 he becomes the Bishop of Chichester. He's then transferred in 1609, or translated, I should say, to the Diocese of Ely, and he finishes up in 1618 as the Bishop of Winchester. He was sidelined after the death of James I, so he's a Jacobean rather than Elizabethan career. His achievements and his strengths: he was a learned, eloquent, thoughtful preacher who had an audience amongst influential people. He was popular and brilliant as a preacher, evident holiness of life, a disciplined spiritual leader, and he wrote a book, a devotional book with the Precies, for rather sombre penitential quality. His intellectual resources, his foreign contacts, and his clever pen made him the Church of England's leading defender and apologist against Roman Catholic attacks. There was a brilliant Catholic guy called Cardinal Bellarmine who wrote a major attack on the right of the Church of England to exist, and Andrews wrote the rebuttal to that. He also saved the manuscript remains of Hooker's Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity. His key beliefs: he rejects the Calvinist doctrine of predestination. We should keep a reverent agnosticism before such high divine mysteries as to who God will choose to save. He held that Calvinism tried to erect into a system what was essentially a mystery, and this diverted religion into speculative and ultimately futile channels. He based the Church of England's title to authority on the fact that her faith is that of the Church of the first 5 centuries. You know, Andrews had a wonderful formula that I try to remember when I get into arguments with people. The Church of England believes in what's now 3 creeds, 2 testaments, 4 councils, and 5 centuries. Like Joel, he insisted that it's the novelties introduced by Rome as De Fide which the Church of England rejected. In other words, from the 5th century on, the rot sets in. He draws a distinction between what's to be believed as a matter of faith and what was novel and uncertain and therefore a matter of opinion. He asserts the same points against the Puritans with opposite effect. Nothing must be rejected which could find support in the custom and practice of the early church. He used church patronage for his family purposes, particularly on behalf of his brother, a distinct underachiever, who relied on his achieving brother to raise him higher. He also used patronage to advance his friends, and that was very common in the Elizabethan era. You know, we decry it now in Italy and places like that, but that's the way, you know, if you, one member of the family rose on high, you were good to the rest of the family. That's the way it worked. Though a resourceful theological controversialist and a popular preacher, with the ears of many, he never backed unpopular just causes in royal or political matters. He took refuge outside his diocese when plague broke out, ran for the hills as fast as he could. He usually resided in his diocese for 3 months of the year. He was almost never there at Christmas, Easter or Pentecost. Now, we would regard that as scandalous for an Anglican bishop to be not there at the major festivals, or to be non-resident in his diocese for 9 months of the year. But of course, he wanted to be near the court and the king. That was which the shots had been called, and he wanted to get on with quietly writing stuff. The great moral mistake of his life was giving way to the king over the Essex divorce case. Yes, we now have to talk about the rather murky private life of James I. James I was a bisexual who by and large preferred men to women, and his court favourites reflected these tastes and interests. The first one was the Earl of Rochester, who wanted to marry the Countess of Essex, who sued her husband for divorce on the grounds that he had never consummated the marriage because he was impotent. This meant the case for divorce had to go to the Archbishop of Canterbury, one Archbishop Abbott. Archbishop Abbott carefully sifts the evidence, plays it with a straight bat and with integrity, and Mox is not disposed to annul the marriage. So James tampers with the panel, who's supposed to be advising the Archbishop of Canterbury. Andrews is on the panel. He's influenced, and he goes quiet and draws his objections to the divorce. So the losing court faction, who was now disadvantaged by the raising up of Rochester, pushes Charles Villiers forward, nicknamed to James I was as Steenie, to win James' affection, a strategy which worked with even more disastrous results on the political governance of Britain. Andrews partly redeemed himself, and this is hilarious, in 1621 when Archbishop Canterbury Archbishop accidentally killed the gamekeeper while shooting deer on an aristocratic estate. In other words, the beaters are out there in front leading the deer towards them, and unfortunately Archbishop Canterbury shoots one of the beaters rather than the deer. Well, the problem with this is that he had committed homicide, he had, by common law, forfeited his estates to the Crown, and by canon law had committed an irregularity leading to suspension from all ecclesiastical functions. So the King gladly excuses the Archbishop from the civil penalties for this misadventure, but the careerist bishop-elect of London, one Williams, refuses to be consecrated by a man whose hands were dipped in blood. So Abbott was disallowed from officiating the consecration of both Bishop Williams and, of course, Bishop Laud, a man who's going to cause a lot of fuss and bother in Charles I's reign. The case is referred to a commission of four laymen and six bishops. And here Andrews plays it with a straight bat, assists the King's pardon of the Archbishop of Canterbury in an independent and liberal attitude, though he had little in common or sympathy with Abbott as Archbishop of Canterbury. So he was a scholarly, generous, weak man, not effective in confronting recusants, in other words, die-hard Catholics in his diocese, or Puritan extremists in dioceses. He was one of those people who was, tough at a distance when he's writing letters. When he gets up close to people, he shrinks from it, he's saying the hard things. There was an excessive emphasis on penitence in his private devotional writings, a man of profound learning and intense study who found life at the top, in all its complexities and publicity, uncongenial, and trying to evade his responsibilities. He took refuge from conflicts of public life in a private and sheltered realm of piety and scholarship. He had an almost mystical belief in the divine right of kings, and therefore found it hard to say no to the king about anything. So what's his lasting legacy for Anglicanism? Well, Paul Wellesby says this, he says the most lasting contribution to English Church lay first in the realm of devotion and piety, and secondly in that of theology and history. He invested the English Church with a positive apologia based on scripture and the fathers, and delivered it from a prerogatively negative defence against Rome, or a too close alliance with Calvinism. He demonstrated the fact that Anglicanism had its own body of theology and its own historical continuity, and thus he established its claim to be a true and real part of the Church Catholic of all ages. In the process of this achievement, he introduced two other features which became characteristic of Anglicanism and which differentiated it from Rome and Geneva: a reserve about points of doctrine which are not central, and a freedom of private judgment outside these central articles of the faith. So in conclusions about these two gentlemen, Hooker and Andrews' contribution to a sense of Anglican identity had been a response to and a reaction against the spiritual vitality of Puritanism and Calvinism, though ironically they both had Calvinist elements in their theology. As this vitality, i.e. Calvinism, ebbed throughout the 17th century, and as Puritanism was rejected by the Church of England, how would this affect the emerging sense of Anglican identity? Has Puritanism re-emerged today as a force in Anglicanism, i.e. the Diocese of Sydney? Is Puritanism the grit and the oyster that makes Anglicanism create its identity? There's an emphasis with these two on the New Testament and patristics that will become dominant theological interests of Anglicanism, but often at the expense of other areas of theological endeavour. It's said that Anglicans often leap from the first 5 centuries of theological endeavour up to the present day and miss out everything in between. Hooker and Andrews, particularly Andrews, in touch with continental European theology, particularly Protestant theology, but this would change after their lifetime. Anglican theology was about to become insular, different to what was going on in the European Protestant churches, and gradually the view grows that the Reformation was something that happened elsewhere. Both of these two have a very pragmatic view of episcopacy. Over time, a heightened valuing of episcopacy will gain momentum to the point where the Tractarians generate a view of the Anglican Church that rests on the episcopal paradigm. The downside are unchurched, non-episcopal churches. But pragmatism remains an enduring element of Anglican perspective on episcopacy. And Stephen Sykes, who's a contemporary kind of ecclesiologist, appealed to Anglican bishops today to stop thinking of themselves as benevolent pragmatists who play a chessboard balancing game with the different power blocks in their diocese. How true that is of many bishops I've looked under. And he talks about the Windsor Report, which points to a kind of rebirth of episcopacy in which bishops will emphasise their central role as expositors of scripture and definers of what the faith is. The unresolved issue today in Anglicanism is the role of the laity as part of the Puritan challenge. The view that Parliament gives the godly laity an important say in the life of the Church won't wash now, because now Parliament's less godly and less Anglican. It's an issue not resolved until the 19th century New Zealand's Selwyn gives lay people a say commensurate with their financing power. You know, Selwyn saw right from the go-get that the laity had to pay for the Anglican Church in this country, and therefore they better have a vote at Synod. And in electoral sense, and they better have a substantial say on vestries. Now, ironically, lay people have a considerable say in choosing what their ministers, a key Puritan demand. It's interesting, over my lifetime, parishes have gained more and more power about choosing vicars, and bishops have lost power. We've gone closer and closer to the American model, the search model. You advertise the job nationally, you can shoulder tap people up and down the country, you interview people. That never used to happen. The bishop would give you a list. Here's 4 people available to move right now. Go and hear them preach and make them mind up. That's how that was done. For Hooker and Andrews, all rests on the Erastian paradigm, the godly prince. As monarchs lose interest in the church along with Parliament, the church would have to redefine itself in a more autonomous way with a different ecclesiology. So these guys were avant-garde conformists, as David McCulloch calls them, who gave Elizabeth I what she wanted. Now, Elizabeth I didn't get what she wanted about single clergy, but she did get what she wanted about cathedrals. She loved choirs. And when you ask, why is it that Anglicanism emphasises, you know, choral evening song and all that stuff, that doesn't happen in many parts of Western Europe. Catholic cathedrals don't usually have choir schools, expensive choirs, developed choral traditions, because Elizabeth I wanted this to happen. Very weird. A reformed church that had cathedrals was the best of medieval music. In valuing the what had been traditional usage and custom, in backing a conservative, cautious style of Reformation, Hooker and Andrews would assist the Church of England in its continuity view of its origins. In answer to the Catholic taunting question, where was the church before the Reformation? Which church did you come from? The answer was, the Church of England is the same church that was here from the beginnings of Christianity in the Atlantic Islands. We are the authentic church, Catholic church here. I'm going to finish with a little story, perhaps apocryphal, about the famous Father Whitty, who was an Anglo-Catholic war horse of the Diocese of Christchurch and spent the early years of his ministry as vicar of Holy Trinity Littleton. And if you know about Littleton in the pre-February earthquake, you'll know that Holy Trinity Littleton was on one side of the street and St. Joseph's Roman Catholic was directly opposite on the other. But at this stage of its life, I presume the signs weren't terribly helpful. And Father Whitty had closely instructed his service in this view of the church. And at one time he was gardening below the kind of parapet of the stone wall and overheard this conversation. He visited Littleton, halted, perplexed in the front of these two churches as to what he was dealing with, and stopped this boy, he was one of Father Whitty's servants, and said, I'm looking for the Catholic Church, which is this? And his standing, the boy pointed to Holy Trinity, this, sir, is the Catholic Church. But what about this one over here? What's that then? That, sir, is the Italian mission. We now open to questions and comments. that existed then, particularly the splendid cathedrals like Salisbury and Durham. And she wanted all that to go on. She liked that. And in the medieval church, you know, there's some varieties of Anglo-Catholics that talk about the serum rite. In other words, it's all based on what happened at Salisbury. And they try and define, you know, the vestments you should wear. Usually servants wear albs, not cotters. And the wonderful choral tradition started, went from all that. And in many parts of Catholic Europe, as I say, that just didn't survive or go on or exist very much. And it's bizarre. I mean, the amount of effort the Anglican Church goes to raise a substantial amount of money to maintain a very well-paid choir director, and a lot of it costs a lot of money to run a decent cathedral choir. Or, you know. But we regard that as a sine qua non. And of course, in the 19th century, as the Tractarians gain power, they try to introduce this style of worship into the parish church. So the whole idea of having, you know, what do you call it, collegiate seating at the front, the choir facing each other, the choir processing in wearing surplice and cotton and cassocks, the Royal School of Church Music, every parish church should have a choir. This is kind of trying to duplicate the cathedral model. In the 18th century, and you can see this in the novels of Thomas Hardy, what used to happen was there was a gallery at the back of the church where a bunch of informal musicians with most unusual instruments would play metrical psalms, and such singers as could be assembled would go along with them. And, you know, long drawn-out culture wars took place for the guys in the gallery to be ejected and for the choir to process them with a pipe organ and led by a crucifer. This took decades, and it really, it's all just come to an end in our lifetime. As you know, David O'Organ said, probably it'll never come back again. But it's only in the last few years all this has begun to unravel. But it still goes on.
What do you see in the future?
About this, you mean? Mm. Oh boy, church music, there's a question. I'm the wrong person to ask you to ask, David. I mean, in that sense, we're caught betwixt and between, aren't we? Because we can't go back to that, though we'd love to, but we don't want to go in many of the directions that church music is going right now.
I mean, I'd rather have a choir than a guitar playing priest at the front.
Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, I must admit, here at St. Peter's, the singing is particularly good. And it's not just because of David, although he's wonderful on the organ, but the fact that the music is in front, and most people can read music. I mean, I know people say, oh, I can't read, but most people can see a note going up and down and things like this. So the singing here, compared with many other churches that I've been in over the last, you know, 30 years, is nowhere near as good, unless they've got a choir leading.
Yeah. And you see, this is where Hooker's inheritance comes in, where he talks about the aesthetic transformation of the liturgy, the psalms taming the passions, and the church music educating the affections. I love that phrase. That somehow doing this changes us. And you know, there are times when we're not feeling particularly centered on God, but it's not just doing it by rote. The rest follows, you know, the body worships in prayer, we follow on. And it's also rather more participational. My supervisor stopped being a Baptist and became a practicing Anglican in the last year or so, and he said, well, you know, the Baptist church, we just didn't participate at all. We just sort of sat there and listened. But at least in the liturgy, you just have to do stuff.
Yes.
That's one of the things about secular funerals. There's no opportunity for the people there, the gathered people, to actually share in doing something. Even as simple as saying the Lord's Prayer, let alone singing a hymn. And it's all done for them. And that's not a really comforting feeling when there's a crowd of people there to support the family. But about Elizabeth I, she too was proficient, very proficient in a number of European languages. She was very intelligent. But she was also into the arts, loved music and dancing and drama and so on. So of course she would have been in favour of worship of a high standard that had that artistic feel to it as well, including choirs and music.
Have another question? You think it's ever likely that we'll return to the days of a prayer book?
That seems unlikely. I would deeply regret the Book of Common Prayer fell out of use. I think that it needs to remain in a treasured place in some parts of every parish's life. I would find it very hard for myself. I mean, that's what I knew all through my teenage years.
Formational. For people like us.
Yes, and it's amazing how its phrases come back to you all the time. So I hope that those who become convinced Anglicans, young Anglicans, by other means, will grow into that. Somebody will expose them to all that later on. It hasn't been written out of our formularies. Theoretically, you're supposed to use it.
To me, it's part of the disunity that you were preaching about on Sunday.
Yes.
You know, if you have a prayer book, everybody knows the service. Whereas now, people can just think up whatever they like, you know, which brings me to a wonderful hymn. I'm sure you all know it, a Colin Gibson hymn. He sings, you know, the words go in this familiar place. He thought about this. It came to him when he was a church in London, at a service in London. And, you know, that is the thing. You can go wherever you like in the Anglican Church, and you would have had that common ground, shall we say. You never felt a stranger if you walked into an Anglican church.
That's been one of the arguments up until recently about what was supposed to unify us across the world.
In a way, it does, because
yes.
It's so familiar to you.
It has to be admitted, though, that even in the good old days, so the early 20th century or late 19th century, it wasn't entirely true that the Book of Common Prayer was being used in every Anglican church. And Anglo-Catholics were often the worst lawbreakers in respect who interpolated large chunks of the Roman Missal, translated into English, into the BCP. In fact, the famous English Missal was really the book, the Roman Missal, with Elizabethan leavenings. It was also true that some extremely evangelical churches dropped the liturgy. What worries me the most about the situation we're in now is that substantial number of Anglican churches, often the most thriving ones in the evangelical tradition, have completely dropped liturgy full stop in every service. They do it ostensibly on the grounds that the unchurched find it really off-putting. I think it's really because the vicars don't like it themselves. And I wonder what's going to happen to us as a church if that goes on long enough. I wonder if there'll be a hunger for it to come back. As we'll be hearing in a lecture on Richard Baxter in a little while, when episcopacy and the Book of Common Prayer was abolished through the long years of the Commonwealth, people missed it. This is one of the reasons why the Anglican Church came back in a very popular way. And a lot of Anglican priests memorised large chunks of it. I mean, they were supposed to be praying extemporary at grave sites. They chanted, they were excited about, that's got people's head. Oh, please, do you think that's a little bit? The minister would say, it comes from the BCP. And maybe that's what will happen. There'll be a hunger for its return again.
Yeah. I'm sure people would appreciate it more if they understood it more.
Yes.
You know, when I was prepared for confirmation, I mean, we had to go to lessons for 3 months. And, you know, we got a paper each time we were there. And so much was explained to us. Not just the prayer book, but, I mean, other things. People today don't teach young people anything about the church.
Well, I believe in a thorough preparation for confirmation, I think, a long time. There are some downsides to the BCP. If you look at the collects closely, there are some quite... teaching some of the collects, some of the most wonderful prayers of all, but some of them are a bit tricky.
Theologically.
Very penitential.
Yes. Well, that's one of the faults with the Holy Communion in the Book of Common Prayer, too, that it returns to this penitential theme several times when it should have been dealt with at the beginning of the service.
But I think it's a great help to me. Like last week at the Archdeaconry meeting, a new archdeacon turned it into a kind of evangelical prayer meeting. And those to break up into small groups to pray for each other. So I fell back on the BCP. At the end of there's a group of collects you can use for any occasion. So I pray for memory like this. O God, the source of all wisdom, who knows our necessities before we ask and our unworthiness in asking, have compassion on our infirmities and give us those good things which in our unworthiness we dare not ask, and in our blindness we cannot ask, except for the worthiness of your Son, our Saviour Jesus Christ. And that covers everything. I'm trying to discharge my obligations in a speaking manner. So I find that, particularly as a vicar, it's really helpful to have a few prayers like that up memorised for any occasion. I remember, like last year, a friend of mine told me she just received a kind of death sentence from an oncologist, and I was on the phone to her, and having a prayer like, it was a different one I used, but that's incredibly helpful in a situation like that.
Is a lot of this Cranmer's work?
Yes, because what Cranmer did was to take the medieval prayers, but with his great flair for language, he could improve them.
Do you think there is a bit of a war on words? Like you're talking about puritanism. What about holiness? Now that means a lot more today.
Yeah, I would be arguing that the Anglican Church has been renewed by successive holiness movements. And it depends on them, and they each have enriched it and brought a different set of challenges, both raising important questions and difficulties with them. But the Puritans were, in a sense, the holiness renewal movement of the 16th century. And the fascinating thing is that they've only just heard of the past. We might be like the Presbyterian Church now. It was a close-run thing. And the Presbyterian Church really only came into existence when the Puritans finally despaired of the Church of England. It's not going to work. They're not going to take our ideas on board. And I'm just fascinated. Every time I go to a classic Presbyterian church, I say to myself, this is the way it might have been. But there's a lot. As I'll be saying next, in two lectures' time, the Puritans' questions they pose to our church have not gone away. And the questions is about how to have a committed, disciplined, church that's clear about what it believes. This has now become a central weakness for us. And the Presbyterians and the Puritans answered that question decisively and helpfully for themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that they continue to put that question to us in a very helpful way.
How did they answer that question?
Well, because the classic Presbyterian system, as I say, for instance, you make sure that people are up to the mark before they receive communion. The minister is seen as the teaching elder of the church. Others can be licensed to preach the gospel, and the elders are there to assist the teaching elder in his pastoral ministry. They have pastoral responsibilities. In other words, as if every member of our vestry was supposed to take pastoral responsibility for a bunch of parishioners and visit them regularly. Good idea, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And it's no coincidence, I think, that often the parishes in the Anglican Church that are the most flourishing are evangelical ones who have taken all this stuff to heart and are pushing these agendas. If you're going to join here, we expect you to be in a Bible study group. We expect you to be giving regularly to church. We expect to see you here regularly. We expect to see your kids as part of the operation. And they ask a lot and they get a lot.
Well, that's true. The Anglican Church doesn't ask to be able to say, well, excuse
it. So being comprehensive and tolerant is great and makes us easy to join, but there's a problem.